Blog Talk Radio.
Truthful Tuesdays right here on Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. I am Sandy Rogers, and I get to be your hostess for this evening. You know, I get so excited every Tuesday. It's like a child with a gift at Christmas time because I'm blessed with the absolute most profound speakers in the world that agree to come on and share of themselves with you, the audience. So, oh, man, look, it's going to be a blast tonight like it always is. But before we get to our guests, you know, there's a couple of things that we always do to get ourselves started. First and foremost, we give thanks to our ancestors for being with us all the time, always, always. We're never separated unless we don't call on them. You know, like we have free will, and they realize that and they honor that. So as we call upon our ancestors, then they come to us. And so we know that they got us front, back, top, and bottom, and we salute them with all of everything that we have. And especially on Tuesday nights, as the conversations sometimes get off a little bit from things that are said out in the open, or, you know, in general public. And so we like that. We are appreciative of that girding that we get from them. So thank you, ancestors, for the strength and the courage to say and speak the words of truth here on Life, Love, and Wellness. So we love you now. We love you forever. Ashe, ashe. The next thing we do is what I call affirmative reading. It's just positive words to kind of exhale from whatever activities you may have experienced during the day. I do a post at revsandy.wordpress.com, and I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs from today's message, which is called Humankind. There is no mistake in the creation of humankind. We are created from the same spirit, the same life force. Spirit never dies. It is in every living thing. We are ultimately joined together by this life force that maintains life in all living creatures. Unity is our natural state of existence. We are each breathing the same breath of life. We are each equipped with sufficient blood to operate our body temples efficiently. We are each endowed with bodies that are designed to heal themselves and create new cells throughout our lifespans. Again, that's called Humankind. And if you would like to receive those automatically in your email, you can go to revsandy.wordpress.com and sign up for them to be delivered to your inbox every day. So it's all about life, it's all about love, and it's all about wellness. So our show today is entitled Illiteracy is a Disease, and I certainly agree with our featured speaker, Noah Rattler, who's going to be joining with us very shortly, and I'll read the show description as well. And audience, you know you are invited to join in the discussion All comments are welcomed and every voice. It is our intention to be heard. You can give us a call at 516-531-9819 and just simply press 1 on the dial to alert us you want to speak live on air with us. And to ensure the highest quality possible for our playbacks, many of our regular guests listen to it at other times or multiple times. Just make sure if your line is open and you're not speaking that you just put yourself on mute until you're ready to add something else to the discussion. You can listen to any and all of the shows on a rebroadcast at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sandy Rogers, and that's S-A-N-D-Y. R-O-D-G-E-R-S. And thank you for listening. Thank you for choosing us today on Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. So we're going to take a quick music break, and then when we come back, I'm going to bring our esteemed featured speaker to the mic and allow him to come on and give us what he has to say. And you better buckle up. This brother's on fire right here. So we'll be right back, you guys. A short music break.
I'm
that was one of our former guests, Dr. Pamelia Sanders, and Unconditional Love, one of her original pieces that I thought would be appropriate for this evening. So welcome back, everyone. Welcome back to Life, Love, and Wellness, the Sandy Rogers Show. Again, our call-in number, if you would like to chat live on air with us, is 516-531-9819. And you would simply press 1 to alert me you want your line open because you have a comment or a statement to make. And thank you for being with us. So tonight's show is called Illiteracy is a Disease. And our incredible guest speaker is Noah Rattler. He has the blessing of being raised in a multicultural, diverse neighborhood and family. So these influences helped him to cultivate a yearning to know more about what was happening all around him from a very young and tender age. He began his journey at Prairie View University in Texas, where his consciousness expanded and he began his life path, weaving all of the parts that he learned earlier together. His journey in 2007 began as he sought to raise the consciousness of individuals on homelessness to the public by walking from Texas to the Pacific Ocean. His determination has him continually searching for the next rung on his ladder of life. He is a true example of what activism looks like in motion. So I'm inviting you to come learn and be influenced on how you can impact your community and the world. And it is my extreme honor and pleasure to bring to the microphone Brother Mr. Noah Rattler. Noah, are you with us?
I am here. Can you hear me, Sandy?
I can. Thank you for being with us this evening.
It is my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
You know, I want to hear your whole story, but I just need to let you know up front that I'm just so intrigued by you walking from Texas all the way to the Pacific Ocean. To me, that is monumental. I know that's not the focus of tonight's discussion, but I just wanted to give you kudos for that. That was extreme, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. It all plays a part. It's all connected. It's all connected. So whenever you want to get into it, we can get dig into that or whatever, because it's all, like you said in the introduction, I seek the connections, and I try to follow them. And so it's all part and parcel of the same story.
Okay. So were you raised in the South? Were you raised in Texas, or is that just where you happened to be when your life kind of came together?
Oh, no. I'm a Houstonian by birth. I was born and raised in South Park, Texas. That's what we call our neighborhood. It's one of the more proud neighborhoods in Houston, Texas. I was born here, raised here. I'm a public school kid. And one thing, if you look at any marketing material on Houston, it says it's the most diverse metroplex in the area, in the country, the most diverse city in the country. And some people may have some arguments about that, but my experience was a big part of that diversity. Even though it was mostly inside of the black community, it's like I learned from a young age that the black community is not a monolith. It's very diverse, and I've had a bit different parts of it have had hands in the pot, in the gumbo that is Noah Rattler. And so,
in the gumbo.
Yes, that's where I'm from. That's why I hail, and I kind of got the whole world in my little neighborhood.
I like Houston, actually. We have family there, and I don't know, for some reason I didn't quite get that you were a Houstonian. So You're probably related to me on some kind of level, you know.
Ain't no telling.
I know, right? But I couldn't tell you the name of the neighborhood, and I'm not going to even lie about it. So.
Oh, yeah. It's, and we all spread out. Like, Houston is such a – Houston is not that – it's 100 – it's a couple – it was started, I think, 1833. And people have been moving here ever since. And so, like, I often say that Houston is the beginning of East Texas, which is its own region for people who are down, who are from Texas. I mean, we think of East Texas as its own place. It's full of piney woods, and it's a bunch of small towns. And it's like it has its own culture. But East Texas is very similar to Western Louisiana. Geographically, it's the same. A lot of people are related back and forth across the border. And so my mom's side of the family is from Houston and Port Arthur and Rosenberg and the local places, the small towns around Houston. But my dad's part of the family is from Western Louisiana, north and western Louisiana, up by Monroe. And so, like, it's this region. I'm like a just that part of it, this region, where there's you can if you go from here to Dallas to Monroe and come back down, even come back down through New Orleans, the culture differs a little bit. The further east you go, directly from Houston towards New Orleans, it gets more of the southern Louisiana thing. But like the closer you get to the border, even if we a couple of cousins away from each other, or cousins and neighbors away from each other, so there's a lot of kinship there, which goes up into Chicago, which goes out into California, which goes mm-hmm. up into Arkansas, which goes over into Mississippi, and it's kind of I look at it as kind of one of the hearts, for sure, of Black America and one of the cultural centers of this country.
Indeed. All right, so tell us about your story right there from good old Houston.
Yeah, Houston, Texas, South Park. I was born at the end of the 70s, back in 78, and grew up, went to the public schools. My time in Houston has been colored by, like you said in the intro, like it was a kind of a diverse upbringing because my parents – like my first real set of friends or people I consider to be family to this day. And they come from, like my parents were Muslim when they raised us. And so they had their own community of Black Muslim families. When we went and spent the night at someone's house, oftentimes it was them. Of course, we had our cousins who were outside of that family, and we went to spend the night at my cousin's house. That was another thing. That's more of the East Texas, West Louisiana connection. But just that upbringing it put me, when I got to school, I understood that we came up in a different situation because majority of friends and family in the area, if I were to kind of generalize, are Baptist, Pentecostal, Methodist, but all across the economic spectrum in the Black community and religious spectrum, different castes of Christianity, different sects. And so that was one variety that added to the spice of my life. And so once we got to school, the neighborhood school, John E. Caldwell Elementary, the Olympians, once we got to that age range, we started to make our own friends. And so these are not people that we grew up with, we were born next to from our parents, but just kids in the neighborhood outside of the kids that lived up and down the street. And that was that was almost the beginning of my conscious recognition of, in a way, being somewhat of an outsider because my family's traditions were different than the traditions of my friends. But made fast friends early on, and many of them we're pretty close to this day. And so that just added another layer to it. And not too far into elementary school, my mother joined the Kaumba House Repertory Arts Theater, which was founded by a group that came, there was a traveling dance troupe, I believe their name was Sechaba, they came out of South Africa, and they settled in Houston. And they were part of the Shape Community Center for a while, and they started their own theater. My mother joined that theater, and so she became a part of this singing, dancing South African dance troupe, and because we often went with her, we became part of the children's group called the Kaumba Kids. And so that
wow.
was a lot of those kids, like they my cousins. These are my family as well. And this
mm-hmm.
was from elementary to middle school. And then once I kind of outgrew that and just deepened my relationship with my other friends in high school, eventually I went to Prairie View, and so that was like the diversity. And of course, I was also always in the magnet program. My elementary and high each school I went to was a magnet school, or at least had a magnet program, and so that added a bit of diversity into the mix, as far as bringing kids being bused into our neighborhood to take advantage of the programs that were at our schools. And so that was there was some added diversity from folks from different ethnic backgrounds, from different socioeconomic backgrounds that were weaved into my friendship matrix and they kind of helped shape a little bit to a young person's mind, kind of a worldview. And that was the diversity part, my Houston diversity story.
Okay.
I grew up in a household with Muslim parents, joined the South African dance troupe, and did gymnastics at schools with kids from all over the world, from elementary and middle school, and joined the aviation club in high school with kids from all over the world. And it kind of gave me a worldview earlier than I think I would have had if I lived in just one community and was only exposed to one thing. And so
yeah, because
that's
pretty diverse what you're saying.
Go ahead.
No, I just said
ma'am?
That from what you're explaining to us, man, that's very diverse.
Yeah, it's a layer here and a layer there, and it's layers on layers in that thing. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed just about all of it. I enjoyed all of it. And that's the outside the world. Inside with my parents, my mother and father, it was the two of them, my older brother Raymond, he's 10 years older than me, then my little sister and my little brother, younger brother, Miriam Rattler and Jonah Rattler. Like we lived in a house. Raymond moved out because he was much older than we were. But we lived in a house, and it just, I like to say my parents, if I were to kind of sum up their lessons in parenting that they taught us, In a really short statement, what I think they learned, what I know they said was think for yourself. They said that all the time. Like, think for yourself. Don't be afraid. It's not about following the crowd. It's like you have to think for yourself because at the end of the day, you're the one that deal with the consequences and the results of your actions. And what they showed me, that's what they said, think for yourself. What they showed me was love other people, love people. And I got that in several instances. People would come stay with us. Relatives came when they were out of home or they couldn't live one place, they come and move in with us. And so throughout all of my childhood up until I was in high school, there was at one point in time or another some of our relatives that would come stay with us. It even got to the point where my parents like let some of my brother's friends come live with us when they had housing instability. And, like, that was, like, the background of my upbringing. I remember two instances, really interesting instances when I was growing up. One for my mom, there was an earthquake in Ukraine. I believe in Ukraine it was the late 80s, and 30,000 people died. And I remember looking at that on the news with my mother, and she was crying. And I was like, why? Why are you crying? We don't know those people. And she was like, but, like, I got the point from her. Like, those are human beings, and they're suffering.
Right.
They suffer like we suffer. And that stuck with me to this day. And in high school, one of my buddies, Jason Luckett, he actually went with me on the walk. We were having a discussion about immigration, and I was really arrogant and thought I knew everything. And I was like, send everybody. Oh, shoot, they want to come live here. Send them up to Alaska. And he brought me back down. I was like, they humans just like we are. Like, they have they just trying to get a better life, just like we trying to get a better life. And, like, I closed my mouth, and I thought about it. And, like, those two, just those two conversations, there have been many others, but, like, those two things, like, really helped shape my worldview as I left home. And, like, and just that and examples of my dad, like, he's, even to this day, like, an example of what it mean, what love really is, just how he interacts with the world. And so I got some really good examples. I had a really good circle of friends, and I had a really unique, almost, upbringing. And throw on top of all of that, I love science fiction, which is something that is, the, in my mind, the best science fiction is the best social commentary you can read. Because you could think about ideas and put and play with them, pick up a concept like discrimination or racism, and you can play with it, turn it around, turn it inside out, and really investigate really big ideas on a really grand scale. And it just helped me, all of that helped me see things, try to see things. I don't see things from my eyes, but I try to see things from different perspectives, and I try to see things from how other people might see it. I try to see things from the small minute to the large big picture as well, and that all of that concoction of influences really started, like you said in the introduction, once I went to Prairie View, it started to really start to take shape and kind of develop into a way of living. A way of being in the world. How is it that with all this stuff I've been influenced by, all the stuff I've learned, all the things I've read, studying mechanical engineering and physics, all these things, like what does Noah Rattler do with all this information and the time he has here on the earth? What does that look like? What do you want to do with this time, this perspective, this empathy that you developed, this curiosity, this desire to make things better, this clarity of sight that you have, what are you going to do with it? And that's when the journey really began. The first step was when I was born to my parents, but, like, my self-direction started, it started to really take form then. And it's been an interesting course ever since. Did I answer the question? I don't know.
It did. I love your response, you know, because you painted such a perfect picture and very unique. I think that for you, as opposed to a lot of the rest of us, you were exposed to so many differences, but there was, like you said, what your parents taught you was to love everybody or love other people. And so when you have all of those pieces, but the center is love, then your perspective on the world and on dealing with other people is altogether different from someone where that may not have been stressed in their household. So I just, you had so much going on, you know, Baptist, Pentecostal, Muslim, that
yeah,
South African
right. Like going
influence. Yeah, for real, for real. So thank you so much, Noah, for being so complete and letting us know your foundation and, you know, what is at the heart of Noah. And we appreciate that. So where do we go from here? You want to talk about Prairie View? Because I know you told me that you initially wanted to be an astronaut. I think that was going into Prairie View, maybe, or?
Yes, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? The only answer, the only thing I've ever really wanted to be is an astronaut. And that was since maybe first grade. And maybe that was because there was a very diverse upbringing, but I did feel like an outsider, so I felt alone a lot throughout my childhood. I felt alone. My father told me once in the last 5-6 years, I mean, maybe 10 years, we went up to Monroe, and he said, no, you've been an observer since you got here. And that just, like, rang true to me. I'm the observer. I watch, and I soak in. But it's like, to be an observer, you're not necessarily a participant. And so there's always a bit of distance. I have a bunch of friend circles, I'm always at somewhat of a distance. Like, I'm not outside the crowd, but I'm on the outskirts of it. And so, like, that distance has been harder at times to deal with, because there was a decent portion of my young life where I really wanted to be a part, but I was not a part. I was at that distance, on the outskirts. And so, but eventually I grew into that, and I came to really appreciate it, and the people around me appreciated it. My friends and family appreciated it before I knew how to appreciate it. And so I eventually grew into it and became more comfortable with it. But that was a lot of, like, my perspective was shaped a lot by that. Now, and going into Prairie View, I decided to change a bit of that and, like, do more to become, I really started working on being comfortable with myself. And so, like, I became more of a social person, had a great time. I stayed there for about 100 years. I did eventually graduate with my mechanical engineering degree and then my physics degree. Throughout all of that time, that love other people and think for yourself was still, like, down at the root, just ticking away, ticking away, ticking away. And so, and that observer in me had early on, maybe at Prairie View, I mean, like, in high school, 11th, 12th grade year, started to really see a larger portion of the world. I remember going back to my elementary school and high school, and it was like, wow, this place is so small. And then coming back to the neighborhood from college, it's like, wow, this neighborhood is so small. Where at one point in time, it was my entire world. So it was the whole universe.
Exactly.
But once I got outside of it, I realized it put my whole, the previous universe in context. It's important, but it's not the whole universe. And so as I grew and the observer in me started to see more of the world, even though I had a worldview, it was from the inside. I started to look at the same places from the outside. And Prairie View exposed me to many more people from all over the country, all over the world. And I realized that there are a lot of things wrong. And when you go into college, I remember my dad telling me this, so I don't remember when it was. He was like, black people who go and study, what was it? I don't know if it was anthropology, or sociology, they all become radicals. And once I start getting into that stuff, I'm like, oh, I understand. Because when you really dig down, it's obvious. It's easy to see that something is wrong, but when you start to look at the reasons why things are off, it's easy to become become radicalized, and it's easy for resentment to grow in the heart. It's easy for hatred to grow in the heart, and it's easy for a bunch of stuff to develop that depends on a whole bunch of stuff. At the root of me, that love that my parents put into me, that love that my friends put into me, when I started to learn this stuff, that was my orientation towards the world. And so it made me start thinking about, like, these are issues, these are problems, but let's fix them. Like, why hadn't anyone fixed this? I'm the first one in the world to see this. Like, all young people think they're the first ones to figure something out. I was one of them. Like, I came out of high school in the Prairie View thinking, I'm going to do this stuff. I'm going to train to be an astronaut, but I'm also going to save the world. Just got to figure out how to do it. And so during this time, that's when I started actually flexing my save the world muscle, trying to figure out, like, I don't even know how to save the world. It's just like, it's so much wrong. What do I have to do? And over the first couple of years of me thinking about this, it was like I've gone to engineering classes, thermodynamics, static dynamics, going to parties. I was a cheerleader on campus, like having a great time. But I was always thinking about this question, like, I want to save the world. How do I do it? How does this work? Now, if anything is possible, we can fix this place. And so eventually I came up with a question to ask myself, and that question was, there's so many problems, but some problems come from other problems. And so it's almost like a tree. And if you got a tree where each leaf is poisonous, and when the leaves fall, they kill something on the ground, you don't go around fighting every leaf. You cut the tree down. And so what problem, if we solve this one problem, would get rid of the most resulting problems? And so, like, as I start to realize that, okay, I'm not invincible and I'm not going to live forever, I need to be able to put my energy in the best place. And I started investigating that. The first answer to that question was to get rid of money, because money is the root of all evil. And I started thinking about it and talking to my friends about it, and that was just my first exercise in it. And it's like, practically, it's going to be a really hard thing to do. And realistically, money doesn't cause the problem. It just amplifies things. What else is there? I remember going through several things, and eventually I got to mental illness. Thinking about, the Romans. I learned something about the Romans. Like, they drank a lot of, the more powerful people drank a lot of alcohol out of these containers made with lead paint, painted with lead paint. Mm-hmm. It's like, what does lead do? Lead makes you, it makes you crazy. Like, if you have chronic lead poisoning, it makes you insane. It makes you more, you have a higher propensity for violence. The decisions you make are more erratic. It, like, breaks down your ability for your mind to function in its natural way, and it makes you exhibit aberrant behavior. And so if this empire that controlled so much of the world around them and had so much influence on the people who wound up building this civilization they inherited a civilization from Africa, and they passed that on to Europe. If the people who led that civilization had chronic lead poisoning, how did that affect the rest of us? Like, the people under their charge, how does that affect them? If they're more prone to violence. And so they developed a culture of violence that they passed on, which has been, at least in my approximation then and still to this day, that culture of violence, it's like it's been passed on, and it's been passed on to this day. And the idea is almost like the idea of institutionalized insanity. You can be born of sound mind and body in a mental institution, and your behavior will adapt to the environment that you're in. You'll like water, you'll be shaped to the container that you're in. And so someone born in a mental hospital could easily, by the time they're a teenager, come outside the mental hospital and seem like they have a mental disability to the outside world, but they're just normal to the inside world. And so the fact that these people with so much power were probably all crazy because they had chronic lead poisoning, they had the illness, but everybody around them suffered from the side effects of the illness, even though they didn't have the illness. And so, like, it's just like that made me think, like, wow, this is, like, it blew my mind, just the idea that this is possible. And so as a problem, mental illness, it causes so many things. So I started looking at it, trying to figure out how would I address it, and that's when I wound up volunteering with the homeless. And because I just did a little research, where are the mentally ill at? Where do people who suffer from mental illness go who don't have the resources to get professional help? Well, oftentimes they wind up being homeless, and oftentimes they wind up being incarcerated. And so the easiest thing for me to really see mental illness with my own eyes on the street level was to go volunteer with the homeless. And that's what I started doing in 2005, which led to me doing the walk across the country to raise awareness for homelessness. So, like, all of these things, like I said, it all kind of leads to it. Illiteracy is like is the next rung, the next phase of that same journey. But during this time at Prairie View, that's when I kind of shaped my approach to the impetus from leaving high school, that motivation to try and make the world a better place. What issue, if we had a limited amount of time to solve, if we could solve this one issue, it would have the most, it had the widest array of positive impacts by solving this one issue. Mental illness was the one that I acted on, the first one that I really acted on. I started volunteering. I realized that homelessness was not just about mental illness. It's about a whole cacophony of things that come from just inefficiencies and failures in our society. It's like, there's a problem in our society that we can't really fix. We don't handle it really well. That problem causes people to be homeless. And so mental illness is one of those. The inequality in the criminal justice system is another one. Just the cost of medical care is another one. Our philosophy on fix the illness, don't prevent it, that's another one. All of these things, in one way or another, wind up putting people on the street for different lengths of time, for different reasons. But homelessness is like a catch-all for all of the problems in our society. And so that's something I learned. And when I learned that, it wasn't just mental illness. Like, people can be totally sane. Their mind can be in optimal operating capacity, and a couple of tragedies can wind up putting them on the streets. That's when I decided to walk to bring attention to this, because homelessness is the big picture. It's all the problems. It's foreign policy. It is, because if war is a part of our foreign policy, health care for veterans when they come back has to work really well. And it works well enough, but it doesn't work well enough to keep a lot of the veterans from winding up on the street. So our foreign policy causes homelessness. Our lack of knowledge about the political process helps our foreign policy get to the point where war is a part of it. And so, like, all of these things play into homelessness. And I'm like, you know what? I need to do something about this. And so when I got my second degree, my physics degree, I had just finished it. I was looking for jobs, and I knew it was going to take a few, just the average wait time. Like, at that time, mechanical engineers graduating school, it was usually a 6-month wait time to get a job. I was like, you know what, I can walk to the Grand Canyon, because it's something I wanted to do. I just wanted to walk across the country. I've been wanting to do it for years. I knew I could do that in 3 months. If I did 20 miles a day, I think it's 1,400 miles, 70 days, I could walk to the Grand Canyon in 3 months, however the math worked out. So I made a plan. And then while I was planning that, I was volunteering. It's like, you know what? If I walk and I bring attention to homelessness, I can probably do some good for SEARCH, the organization I volunteer with, and a bunch of organizations across the country. I wound up doing it. It took longer than 6 months, and I never went back to engineering. It, like, the course of my life changed after that. But that act, walking from Houston to Dallas to Amarillo to Albuquerque to Flagstaff to the Grand Canyon, through the desert, all the way through Los Angeles to Santa Monica, 20 miles a day for 90 days, over 134-day period. All of that came from the desire to bring attention to homelessness, which came from me trying to figure out a solution to that question, which is mental illness, the issue that if we solved it, it would get rid of a bunch of other things. And so, like, that was an aspect of it. I did it. The walk was fantastic. It was, like, super transformative to me. It was a super powerful thing to myself, to my community. It's still inspiring people to this day. And it did way more than I thought it was going to do, and it didn't do enough. And so when I finished it, I pivoted. Like, I had some time to relax. I mean, like, that's not necessarily relax. It took me quite a while to recover. And when I finished walking, some of those unintended consequences happened. I was in a kind of a – I was, like, broken physically and mentally for a while.
Sure.
And
yeah,
I had
yeah,
to put
yeah.
myself back together. Yeah, yeah. And like, I didn't expect that. But as I was getting close to the end, another conversation with my father, he was like, you know, I can't remember the guy's name. This guy rode across the country on his bike in the early 80s. And, like, the reporter came up there to ask him, like, you've done this fantastic thing. How do you feel? And the guy got out, and he was, like, standing next to his bike. He said, I'm in the midst of the greatest depression. And he got on his bike and rode off.
Wow.
When I got
yeah.
to the end of that walk, I understood very clearly how that individual felt. I understood very clearly. So it took me a while to put my mind back together. It took me a while for my feet to stop hurting to the point where I can get back out and work. But during that time, I started my first garden, and that was, like, that led to something years down the line. This is 2007, years down the line. I grew the garden, ate some food from it, and that in itself was a seed that was planted that's still starting to bloom right now. But, yeah, I came back, kind of recovered over time, and redeployed my efforts. I started this thing called the Houston Sleep Out. People spend a night outside once a year. Homeless people come talk to us, and people from the homeless service provider, they come talk about how to help homelessness. And that all of that, we did that for several years in the city of Houston, and I think we did a couple of them in Dallas and universities in the area. And eventually in 2013, a classmate of mine from high school came back from home. She's like, Noah, her name is Keisha Pig. She's like, Noah, I want to write a book about your story. She wants to do a children's book.
Nice.
And she interviewed me and was like, all right, let me come up with a story. She came up with it like, that ain't really, she's like, well, help me. So, okay, we came together. We wrote the story. I had a friend who was doing children's books. We found the illustrator through her. We got the book published, and in January 2014, I was standing in the kitchen. I was, like, out in her front yard, and I had that book in my hand. No, it was after we got the first book. We went over there and, like, did a social media thing. Yay, we got our first proof. And I was sitting at home outside my apartment holding this book in my hand, and I really thought, it really dawned on me how powerful a thing it is to have this book. So if I get hit by a car today, if I got hit by a car on January 15th, 16th, oh, that was my dad's birthday, I'm glad it didn't happen. But, like, the day after this book was published on Amazon, it doesn't matter. It's going to exist forever.
Yes.
All intents and purposes. This book can go places that I can't go. Anyone in the world can order this book from Amazon and have the story that we tell in the book that educates and kind of introduces people to homelessness, but it is really about motivating young children to get out and make their communities better. And so, like, that was a very profound, one of the most profound moments in my life, sitting there holding that book and seeing the actual power of this tool. And so I started looking around. I was just more interested. I was thinking about doing a book eventually, but, like, not a children's book. And so I started looking into it. An article started coming through my – when I got a book, then, like, Facebook and social media know what you're doing, so they start sending you stuff about what you're doing. And some article came across my timeline about the disparity in the number of children books published for black and non-white children. I think during that year there were 3,000 children's books published, and there were less than 170 that weren't that didn't have white children or animals or trucks or like automobiles as the central character. And that 170 is less than half of that had black people as the central character. And so, like, it's not that I have anything against white children or trucks or animals, but, like, it is good for all children to see black children or black people as the center of the stories they read in childhood, because that helps. That creates those books you read. Like, if you give a book to a child's mind is, like, full of possibilities, but it's empty on facts. Like, they have very little experiences. And so, like, they'll love to... They'll watch a movie 1,000 times, and that's the best thing they've ever seen, because they haven't seen that much. They'll read a book 1,000 times. They want you to read it to them over and over and over again, because that's what's filling their mind. That's the best book they've ever read, because they haven't seen that many books. And so over time, as children age, it's the media that they consume that helps them build their worldview, helps them see what the world is about, and you learn so much through reading. It's like a tool that helps you build empathy. You get to see things through other people's eyes. If you don't see yourself in the books, there's this outsider syndrome that is easy to develop. And so me having this book with my black smiling face walking across the country on the cover, like, that became much more important again after reading that article. And back then there was a hashtag called hashtag we need more diverse children's books. And so I just started to think about it then, and like just the idea of that made it just, I went back to the drawing board, and I started calling a couple of my friends who were teachers and asking them about just about literacy and, like, what they think. And so doing this is, like, all in 1 month. The idea that, like, one of my math teachers, Dr. Freddie Frazier at Prairie View A&M University, he taught all the engineers and stuff to higher math classes. And he wasn't a mathematician. He was a math educator. He had a PhD in math education. He's one of the best teachers I've ever had. And I remember something rang out to me. If you don't understand the definitions, you can't do the math. You have to know the definition. You have to understand what this word means. And so like being in engineering and physics, I should have been in sociology or something else where you just read a lot and remember words and theories. Math has always been foreign to me. I've always had issues with it. And once he told me that, like, the definitions help me get the concepts, and the concepts help me get the numbers right. And so just thinking about that and then talking to my friends, it just got me to start really thinking about, because of some of the other stuff and the other organization I was part of, little facts came across my mind and just came across my head, like the school-to-prison pipeline. It really, like, just... the skies opened up, and I had this big idea. Illiteracy is one of those issues, because there are so many of us that wind up leaving our fundamental education, like K-12 education. So there are a lot of people who don't graduate from it, those who get passed through it without being able to effectively read for comprehension. And I knew from being in some of my upper math classes, from listening to my professor, that if you didn't understand the definition, you can't do the math. And you can do arithmetic, but you can't do that other stuff, the abstract stuff. And so, like, it was a hindrance on me not knowing the definitions. When I learned the definitions, it helped me. I started talking to my friends who were teachers and just asking about this, like, how important is it for the stuff that you specialize in, for kids to be able to read. And, like, listening to their personal experiences with illiteracy and children not being able to read, it really brought those numbers out. Like, young black boys not being able to read by third grade, they have a hard time. They just have a hard time in school. Not being able to keep up with the class makes you somewhat of an outsider. And that makes it easier for you to not pay attention or to seek other ways to get attention, and then that makes you more vulnerable to the fact that black children get punished at a higher rate than other children. And so once that cycle starts, as you get a little bit older, black children are seen as to be more adult sooner than other children. And so now you get to the age where there's this cycle that's been created where now you're used to being punished harshly, and so there's little incentive for you to do to try anymore. And so eventually you get to the point where you can leave school, and if you are of the group of young people who leave school because they did not get that foundation of being able to read for comprehension, you're locked out of a lot of opportunities in the world. Oftentimes, you've been through, you got papers on your name, so you've been through maybe getting into a fight or got kicked out of school and wound up and having to deal with the police on one instance or another. There's a large amount of children at the schools that I went to and schools like it in Houston, I'm sure across the country, who have had a run-in with the police for things that 30 years ago they wouldn't have had to deal with the police for.
Exactly.
With zero tolerance that came into view. And so, like, those children are now treated like adults and held responsible for knowing things that they didn't get back in elementary school. And so they're locked out of a lot of the opportunities that this society offers. If you can read, there is a whole universe of things that are available to you that are not available to you if you didn't develop those skills to read early and then build up on those skills, because education is comprehensive. Once you get to read for comprehension, then you get all these other skills these other skill sets that you have. So, like, if you don't develop those skill sets, it's difficult to get them later. You can get them, but it's just difficult to get them later when you can't get off the treadmill and keep moving. And so the opportunities that are available to you there's a higher propensity for those opportunities to lead towards the track of not just having a good job or becoming a president or CEO or all those great things, or just having a decent life, working a good job that you enjoy. You have the opportunities that are open to these children are more likely to lead to incarceration. And so it's so likely that prison beds are built based on reading scores in the third grade. Like,
yes.
Talking to teachers who saw this happen, like, I'm not a teacher, I'm not an educator. Back then I wasn't speaking to schools a lot. I was just someone who had a book about something that I did and was, like, really investigating the power of that. I had heard the statistics before, but I didn't know, I didn't have that personal aspect. So talking to a couple of my friends who were teachers, like, made all of that real. And it's like, oh, if we could get these kids to read, get these reading scores up, it would improve things. So, like, I felt super great about having a children's book that I came to find out that children love reading. It's one of those books that a child will keep picking up again and again and again. It's mostly because of the, like, especially young children. The first person to ever read my book to me was this 3-year-old girl. She couldn't read. We were in Baltimore, and this baby, this little toddler, I knew she was read too because she knew what the act of reading was. She loved the pictures. It was really well-colored. And so she sat down next to me and read my book to me. And whatever she made up, she couldn't even talk well. But she went through the motions of reading the book to me. And, like, that was, like, one of the most profound things that's happened since getting that book. And it was, like, months after getting the book.
That's special.
And so, like, I know children love it. Children love the book.
Right, right.
If they read it
enough,
they'll get the concept. Oh, the book is called Noah's Walk.
Okay.
It's called Noah's Walk. It's we got it. We self-published it on Amazon. We got it translated into Spanish and French, La Caminata de Noah. and La Marche de Noir. And in Spanish and French, it's all available on Amazon. We even got an audio book out, which is just great audio book. But it's a beautiful thing. It's so beautiful that, like, Phyllis Hunter, who was like a reading expert, a literacy expert, she was like, and she was a scout for Scholastic. She picked up the book and put it in the Scholastic, and Real Men Read. And, like, I get pictures every now and then from Real Men Read in different parts of the country, where they'll pick my book to read it to the students. And it's like, it's great. It's great. It's a beautiful book. Children love it. And the fact that children love it makes me feel like I'm helping children develop a love of reading.
Well,
and
of
so,
course you are, yeah.
It all goes back. Say it again, Sandy.
I say, yes, of course. You know, you are an active part of that. Yeah.
Yes. And it's just one part, it's one piece. I'm just one book on that pile of 3,000 or so books that get published every year. Every little step counts, because every little step takes you further towards your destination. But really having that as a piece of that puzzle and a contribution to knocking down this tree where illiteracy is the root and incarceration is one of the... And it's not just incarceration. That's not the only problem. Like, there are plenty of people who don't read well, and most of them don't go to prison. It just helped me develop just, like, this new how do I save the world. What one thing, if it can be fixed, will have the greatest benefits. And, like, as sitting here 43 years old on October the 12th, in a hot summer afternoon, a hot fall evening in Houston, Texas, literacy in the black community is like number one in climate change. Like, those are the two things for me. Those are the two things. They're more important than anything else. I think, if we really jumped in to deal with those things, they would have the greatest benefit for the most people that I care about and that I can think of. That's where I am now. That's kind of how I got there. The idea that I play my little part, but like as time goes on, I've sat here with this book and I've read it to children. I've had children read it. I know people have read it to children. I know it's a bunch of children's first book. It's a bunch of children's favorite book. It's helping people develop a love for literacy, but, like, the bigger picture is, like, my best-case scenario is if the community would, like, really adopt this as something that's of utmost importance to us as a community. Because literacy doesn't start when you're in school. It starts when you're in utero. Literacy starts when the tools that are necessary for a teacher in kindergarten to teach you to read are developed when you're 1, 2, 3, 4 years old. It's in the number of words that you hear. It's in the amount of times you've been read to and the amount of times you've attempted to read. If you hear a word a bunch of times, when you see it, knowing your alphabet, knowing what animals, the sounds animals make. It's your brain playing, like, because words are just symbols. One word doesn't mean anything without a context. And it's a symbol made up of symbols. Letters are symbols to represent possible sounds that we make. And so to understand the symbols that are language on a written form, you have to have the concept in your head. And so the more words you hear before you start trying to read, the more likely it is that you'll recognize a word. If you haven't heard the word prestidigitation and you try to sound it out, you won't know where the word is going. But if you're familiar with the word prestidigitation, when you see the letters, if you understand the letters and how they work, it's easy for you to sound that word out. It's easy for you to lock that word into your mind, into your database in your head as the physical, the visual representation of a concept that you already have in your mind. And so these things, like, you have, even if you don't teach your child to read. I knew how to read before I got to, like, before I got to school.
Right.
My parents, like, had us in, like, almost like a daycare. It's like a community daycare. Sister Zara, she taught a lot of us. She loves read, like teaching, and she babysat us, and she taught us, had us ready to read by the time we got to kindergarten. All the school was easy because I knew how to read. Like, I was a terrible studier because I think that I always attributed to this. People are like, no, you're smart. No, I can read before I showed up to school. And so, like, I was always kind of ahead. And so later on it hurt because I never really learned to study until, like, I had been suffering in college for a while. But, like, it just made everything so much easier because I could read by the time I got to school where other children were trying to learn to read. I had that framework, that baseline, that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that time that my parents spent with me talking to me and reading to me and going through animal sounds and picture word identification. All of those things helped me get a vocabulary that made it easier for me to recognize things when I started sounding stuff out and reading it. And so that prep work was done. And that's what's necessary for us to get children ready. And so the schools can only do so much. Do they get a child when they're 4 or 5 years old? Universal pre-K would be great. And so, like, that's a heavy lift to get children earlier, 3, 4 years old, across the board, give high-quality universal pre-K to all children. That would be spectacular. But it's still, if you're just getting introduced to these ideas and these concepts and this mode of information acquisition when you're 4 years old, you're still behind the child that started getting just exposed to it when they were born. They learn to talk with more complex words, more complex ideas.
And, you know,
ideas.
I think that's one of the you shed a lot of light. I know for definite that it was not a problem within your household. But, you know, a lot of families speak baby talk to young children. You know, yeah, and that has always just infuriated me, you know, like, why don't you talk in complete sentences? And so, you know, listening to what you're saying, how you're breaking it down, it makes sense where that was adding to their inability to read and to comprehend what they were reading. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
My granddaughter,
go ahead.
No, I was just saying, my granddaughter, she was speaking in complete sentences before she was 2 years old, and people were always amazed with her, you know. But I'm like, no, we're not doing that baby talk stuff, you know. No.
Right. They soak in all the information that's around them. We soak in all the information that's around us at a greater rate at that time than any other time. And so you spend your child's early years talking to them in baby talk, and then you're frustrated because you got to correct their grammar for the next several years. Probably because you didn't. that could be fixed by speaking to them like you want them to speak, and they learn what you give them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy to baby talk because they're so cute. And it's like a natural thing for all mammals to, like, use a higher pitch of voice when talking to babies of their same species. Like, the pitch always goes up, and it's like some things that happen. It happens across cultures. We all do it. But, like, you can speak in a high-pitched voice, but just speak in complete sentences.
Right.
Speaking complete sentences, and they will and they will learn to speak in complete sentences as well. And you see these things on television where, this 9-year-old child is doing calculus and teaching other students. They're a genius. I like the idea of genius, but I like even more proper preparation. When you prepare a child correctly and you feed them the right way, that you feed them good stuff, that's what they'll be made of.
Right.
And so if that goes into food, you give a person good food, their body will be made of the good stuff they put into it, as well as information. Like you prep them right. Like I'm a farmer now. A lot of stuff has changed since we talked last, Sandy. I've been working at a neighborhood farm, and like just part time for the last few years, and now I'm like the farm manager. And so
okay.
growing food has been a huge part of my life for the last several years.
Yeah.
And so it's very literal. And when I say this, what you feed the plants that they develop is going to affect the quality of food that you harvest.
Yeah.
And how you treat them as they develop is going to affect what you sow. How you treat what you reap is going to affect what you sow. And so it's a major thing. And the ideas that we just talked about, my best case scenario is we as a community adopt these ideas and this information and make it an important thing for us community-wide.
Mm-hmm.
Like to really push towards, if not literacy, literacy prep. One of the things most people don't know, of the children who wind up incarcerated, going through the prisons, the cycle of incarceration and homelessness throughout their adult life, the amount of people who are dyslexic in a greater population are about 3%, I believe. The amount of people who are dyslexic in the incarcerated population is over 60%. So over 60%. And so think about that. When do we find out that children are dyslexic? When they're in elementary school. It's too late to find that out. We should be finding that out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And if we were focused on literacy, we could find this out. If it was easier to know how to teach your child how to read and how to check for these things, these alternative brain architectures that make it difficult for a child to read certain fonts. So like, okay, oh, my child is dyslexic. All I have to do is change the font on the computer. There are certain fonts that work better with the dyslexic mind. That's something I'm just learning. There are certain fonts that help with that. There are, even out without the fonts, there are different. You teach someone who has a mind that works that way, you teach them differently and they can learn to read just like everybody else. But if you don't know to look for that,
mm-hmm.
yeah, the child can be labeled as junk.
Yeah.
Or can be put in, they can be subjugated to the class with the disabled children where they're totally functioning, it's just they need a different way to learn. And so
exactly.
If we as a community start to really look at this literacy thing earlier in our child's lives and make the resources available and accessible and the information much more available and accessible and almost make it like as a priority, we'll find these children earlier, and so
mm-hmm.
we can get them on the right course. And so all of those children will go through that cycle of being punished more and dropping out of school and being subjugated to ways to support themselves that are more likely to put them into the incarceration cycle. So many of them are dyslexic.
Right.
And that's
right.
the real root. If they aren't bad children, they're trying to live in a world that doesn't accommodate them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and that world actually kind of rejects them because they have this, their brain is wired differently, and if we knew that their brain was wired differently, we could make accommodations and put them on track to like be to go out there and save the world or just have a comfortable life and
give them
the opportunity
that
everybody else has.
Yeah, and some of that may be the whole process of being stripped of our native tongue and means of education and forced to learn a whole different language, and that may be the reason behind it, you know, thinking back on that particular, because I do know some grown folks with that are dyslexic, and they managed their whole life, you know, without ever knowing that,
mm-hmm.
and then once they were diagnosed and was able to, like you say, you know, like change the font and all of like that, how much better they were able to operate in the world. But I know you could go on. We're down to about 15 minutes left, and I want to just open up the lines in case. I know. I told
I can you. Talk. I'm glad you said something.
So for anyone have a comment, question, or just want to speak to Noah, our call-in is 516-531-9819, and just press 1 on the dial to be able to talk live with us. Otherwise, as you've heard, Noah does not have a problem with just sharing all of his knowledge and so much useful information with us. And I'm so appreciative, and so I don't see anyone right now. So, Noah, one of the things that I was really intrigued by were the number of children books when you were given the statistics on that, the 3,000 children books and only 170 of the books were by black authors, and
the 170 had characters that were not white children, white people.
Oh, characters.
Automobiles,
okay.
Or animals as the central character. So they had, they may have a Asian or Latino or black central character. Like the book was about them, or like that was the star of the book. It was less than 170, and like of that 170, it's almost, I think it was less than 50, or it was about 50 or 60, was focused around black children, black black people,
okay.
So a black child can see themselves as the center of this story.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that. The numbers are still staggering, you know?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah. So that should be a push to anyone that's listening that has a gift of writing or would like to develop a gift to write. You know, you have a story to share. You've got information to share. Put it in a children's book. Get you an illustrator and work with that. And let's get our young people accustomed to seeing themselves in these books and reading stories that are written by us. It's so important for us to write our stories. Just so important.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, if somebody gonna tell your story, is it gonna be you or somebody else?
Somebody else tell it.
they can't tell it like you can, and they'll make you look the way they want you to look.
You know
so,
it. You
like
know
we have,
it.
Really have to control our narrative.
Mhm. Even
yes,
if it's not a children's book, you know, we've
right.
we've got to write it. We've got to write it. And it's so important because, you know, that the same way that we're talking about how the dyslexic may have its origin, it's the same way about, I know for me coming up, you know, I didn't know that we contributed anything to history. Because there was nothing in the books about, you know, any contribution of anybody of color that did something good, you know. And then on TV, there was the Tarzan movie, you know, and a white man had to come and save the Africans. And, you know, and some older people, I'm serious, you know, like my first trip to Africa, and some of my elders was like, don't let them eat you. And I was like, what did you just say? You know,
yes,
and I'm like, really? So even, you know, that thought was still in people's minds. And so it's been so carefully orchestrated in, like, how we view ourselves and how we view people with a darker skin tone that we just absolutely must tell our stories. It's
oh, yeah, definitely. And It's of utmost importance to us. It's also of utmost importance to people who ain't us, so they can really see where it's like one of the things I feel sorry for people who have been raised to believe that they're superior, but they aren't. Because you have you living in a fantasy world. And the world tries to uphold that, but, like, it doesn't – you find out pretty quickly when you get around other people who aren't like you that you're not superior and you're just like everybody else. And you and oftentimes, like, mediocrity is – you can be mediocre and be put above somebody who is spectacular. And so, like, they need to see us as well to really understand their real place in the world, not the place that they think they're born into. We need to see us to understand that we have a part. We have a part. Yeah. We played a really important part in creating all of this stuff you see around us, space travel, all that stuff. Without our contributions, none of this would be here. And it just, like, to me, it's like really the truth. As we move closer towards a true understanding of where we are, to get a real understanding of where we are, to make the world the place we want it to be, we have to know where we came from. And the way I think about it is like if I like write down the directions from where I am to Dallas, and I give you those directions, you won't be able to get to Dallas. You need a different set of instructions to get you to Dallas from where I am. You can't follow my instructions, and I can't follow yours. We can still get to the same place. We can still get to the same place, but we both need to clearly understand where we are, what our starting point is, in order to get to that destination. And if I'm trying to get to Dallas using your direction, I'll never get there. And so, like, that's what going through history is in a lot of schools for a lot of people. I had a bunch of teachers who slide that in and throw a little extra stuff on it. But I understand how a lot of people just come up and they don't get exposed. And then, I had to read a lot on my own after I left school to get a deeper understanding of, like, what is the real story, the larger picture of me and the people who came before me and the people who came before them. And what kind of stuff were we doing a long time ago? Oh, we were doing all of this. We were creating ideas that other civilizations took and built their civilization on. We were creating technologies and understandings of the world that other people learned from us and went to build other things on. This is the stuff we did. So we were part of their building their civilization. Oh, that's what the whole story is. So I kind of have an idea where I'm coming from. And it makes it easier for me to make that trajectory to where I'm trying to go. And we all need that. We all need it.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about your garden. We're down to about 6 minutes left. Tell us what you're doing, what you're growing, and is it a community garden or, you know, what do you have going on?
So there's a HIV, the school district, and the city has been moving, and it's always in flux. And so neighborhoods change sizes, schools get closed, new schools get open. A bunch of schools were closed back in the mid-teens, 2000-teens, and, like, one of them I wanted to get to school if I can get this property. It was like $600,000. It was way out of my price range. I wanted to get it and grow food on it, grow trees on it, and teach people how to grow stuff. Eventually, I met someone who was the farm manager of an organization that had got the property, and they were going to start a farm there. So I went and talked to them, and I started. I wanted to volunteer, and they said, "Well, we can pay you." I'm like, "Okay, I'll do it." And I started working there, and I took this as an opportunity to learn how to grow food on a somewhat small to medium-sized scale, bigger than a backyard garden. I took this opportunity to get paid to learn something I wanted to do. The organization was called Recipe for Success, and it was founded by a woman who wanted to help kids learn to grow food and cook food so they would eat good food. You're much likely to eat a zucchini if you grow it and you know how to cook it. And so, like, that's what our organization was doing, and they were looking for a property, they found it. And I started working there part-time in 2016. I was doing a bunch of other stuff throughout most of the time. And this year, the farm manager had some good opportunities, and me and him worked real close together. And he left, and we didn't have a farm manager, so I jumped in I took on the role. And stepped into the role. And so, like, now I'm the manager of this small community farm, that grows food for Sunnyside and the rest of the Houston community. We have all the right now we got a bunch of okra and peppers and some squash growing and a couple of greens, and we're starting to get ready to put in all the fall and winter crops right now. We're starting to put those in. We sell stuff every Saturday, Thursday, and we have a subscription box that we sell to some restaurants. The community gets a discount. If you're located near us, you get a community discount. Mm. And if you want to, it's a good operation. And so I'm kind of excited about this new opportunity. I'm learning as I go and growing a bunch of food for my community and the rest of the city of Houston. It's a good thing. And maybe there'll be a book come out of this. I'm not sure because I may want to make another contribution
to that pile. Oh, for sure, because a lot of people, they're asking for that. They're wanting that, And so it's so addictive growing your own food.
It is.
Yeah, man.
No potato tastes better than the one you grow. Yes, ma'am.
I know. Nothing tastes, and I tell people, and I know if you've never been in the habit or if you've never eaten food that you've grown, you really can't have an appreciation for it. But all it takes is like to eat one tomato or one okra or, eat the kale or the collards out the garden, and you're hooked for life. You don't even want to go to the store and buy the other stuff. So
for life. Well, like I told you, when I was recovering from the walk, I grew that garden, and that seed is germinated, and now I'm reaping that harvest now. I ate like a cantaloupe was the first thing to grow. And when I bit into that cantaloupe, it wasn't the best tasting cantaloupe, but it like changed my whole world view. It's like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah.
You say all you have to do is eat one. I ate that one and I was hooked.
I know.
I couldn't do much about it, but like right now I'm doing a lot about it. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, congratulations. We'll have to share some stories on that because I think my life has changed a little bit. But I still get over to that garden every chance that I have, And I just planted some, some broccoli, collards, garlic, and some romaine lettuce. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'll have my greens coming up pretty soon.
Yes, ma'am. Tis the season.
Yep. Yes, it is. Oh, I love this fall. The fall crops are magnificent. So,
they're so pretty and delicious.
Yes, indeed. And we're coming up. We got about 60 seconds left in the show. And thank you. I tell you, it's been so informative and. We've learned so much and had our eyes open to just a newness about looking at things. And I appreciate your point of view and all that you had to share with us. Would you please give us how to be in contact with you, how to follow you, give the name of your book again, and any parting thoughts that you would like to share? We got 60 seconds left now.
I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram at Noah Rattler, NoahRattler. Noah like the art, Rattler like the snake. My book is called Noah's Walk. It's everywhere online. You can buy a book, and the audio book is on Amazon, Apple, and the other one, audiobooks.com. And it's really simple. The world we live in tomorrow is built on the things we do today.
Mm.
And so we have to be conscious about how we act and how we live, how we present and show up so that the effects of what we do today create the world we want tomorrow. And I'm trying to make it a better place, so I try to live that way today. I'm not trying to live better tomorrow. I'm living better today so that tomorrow is a better place. So that's all I got, Sandy. That's all I got.
Well, that's been absolutely perfect, and I so appreciate you. And, again, the gifts being so freely shared with everyone. We appreciate you. And for the rest of you guys, we'll see you next week, same time, with another outstanding. Care of yourself, stay healthy, stay wise, and be safe. Thanks a lot. We love you. We'll see you next week. Thanks again, Noah.